Hey, it's Francis. With July 4th coming around the corner, we wanted to take you back to a show we did last year around this time to get you in the mood for the cookout, and especially for the desserts you're going to want to bring to the cookout. Have a listen. I'm Francis Lamb, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM. Honestly, it seems like just yesterday when I was thinking, wait, was that spring? And boom, here we are. It's nearly July 4th and the official beginning of, you better enjoy this now because Labor Day is on its way, part of the summer. So today we are going to go hard on enjoying that summer. Later in the show, we'll have the wonderful baker Sam Senavaratna, author of The Joys of Baking, to talk about easy, amazing summertime desserts. We're going to start with one of my favorite cooks, Andy Barragani. A longtime restaurant cook, Andy started developing recipes for websites and magazines years ago, most recently for Bon Appetit, and he's created this signature, fresh, light style that I just love. His debut cookbook is called The Cook You Want to Be. He's here to talk about that and what we should be making and eating out in our backyard this week. Hey, Andy, it's great to see you.
Hey, Francis, very happy to be back.
So congratulations on your book. It's a New York Times bestseller. But I actually want to talk to you about the title of the book. It's The Cook You Want to Be.
Yeah.
Which a little bit I was like, wait, you're the cook I want to be? But then I realized, oh, it's about becoming the cook that you want to be. So who is the cook I want to be?
Yes, I'm not. I promise I'm not so presumptuous. You know, it's funny that you brought up the title. The title actually originally is The Cook I Want to Be. And it was quite personal, the proposal I wrote. And it was about kind of the personal lessons I've learned throughout my life, working in restaurants, growing up as first generation Iranian American, my travels alone and working in test kitchens, and kind of gathering these lessons and really seeing what I've learned over the kitchen. But then eventually, halfway through writing this book, I thought, this is not just about me. I really need to bring the reader in and have them kind of become the cook they want to be, empower them in the kitchen. So I changed the I to you. And I think in some ways it made all the difference.
Well, do you mean it made all the difference in terms of like then you were writing it in a different way? Like you had the reader in mind in a different way? Or
yeah, I wanted to kind of extend a hand to the reader. I thought it was very important for me to kind of think about there's so many incredible cookbooks, and you're obviously so aware of this, and we're really in this kind of renaissance in cookbooks, and my book aside. And I think one thing that I was really conscious of is that I didn't want to take this authoritative approach when writing the recipes and writing this book. I wanted to kind of have a kind of gentleness in writing the recipes so that it feels like I'm right there with you in the kitchen, kind of just going along, whether it's any kind of struggle or triumph, I'm right there, and that it's okay if something goes kind of wrong, we'll be able to fix it together.
Yeah, I love that. Okay, so let's continue in this journey of exploration. You know, let's imagine a great summer cookout, like a 4th of July cookout. And we've had great conversations about grilling in the past, and I think people automatically go to grilling in their minds when they think of, you know, cooking out for the 4th of July or having a picnic or whatever. But I don't know. I also feel like it's a nice time to spend time with people. Like I've actually seen so many friends in the last couple of weeks. I haven't seen them forever. And like, I just think I don't want to stand there at the grill all afternoon long if I am having people over right now. I want to, you know, maybe use the grill for flavor or whatever, but help me think of some ideas. Like what would be a really great menu for gathering, grilled or not, this 4th of July?
I have to say, I'm right there with you. 4th of July, really any holiday or anytime I have guests over, I want to kind of be strategic with my menu so that I'm not just always at the grill or on the stove and in the kitchen. And then, you know, it ends up being 10:30, 11 o'clock and you're not able to see your friends. I think a big part of it is kind of breaking down the dishes where some are hot, some are not. So not everything needs to be a la minute. Some things can be made ahead of time, cold dishes, room temperature dishes, which I think, which are very forgiving. And kind of what you do want some of those dishes. You don't need everything to be hot for 4th of July, if hopefully the weather holds through. So I guess I try to think of how many guests I'm having. I will be having guests over for this 4th of July, so probably around 6 people. So it's a small gathering. But I crave, especially in the summer, I'm just craving a lot of salads with a lot of textures, vegetable forward. And so we can talk. You want to talk about what I'm making?
Sure.
So I always kind of have a main that isn't necessarily have to be, depends on a protein. So I have some kind of big grain salad of sorts. And in my pantry, Lord knows how many grains I have. But I think something like a farro or a frika or a bulgur salad, where you could make those grains ahead, boil them up just like you would with pasta, and then mixing them up with, I just do a ton of herbs, whatever I have, tender herbs, mint, parsley, tarragon, cilantro. I add a lot of kind of briny olives. I love the kind of meaty Castelvetrano olives. And then just a big hunks of Parmesan as these kind of surprise cheesy bites to it.
A good
amount of acid and oil. And really, that is something that it almost gets better as it sits. And I would say you could make it, you know, the morning of, or even the day before, and just kind of zhuzh it up right before serving.
Yeah, so that's like a great base to have on the table. It's almost like, oh, if you want to make a plate, that could be the first thing to go on your plate.
Yes, that's definitely one of the things that I definitely will be making. July is when, you know, tomatoes really start getting to a good place, so I do want to sneak those in the menu. And I'm the type where if the tomatoes are really good, I really don't need to mess with them too much. I think a little goes a long way. And one of my favorite recipes, I have to plug my book, is these tomatoes. It's called Juicy Tomatoes with Italian Chili Crisp. And really all you do is take tomatoes, cut them up into wedges or regular pieces. No need to be perfect. Season them with a good amount of salt. Splash them with some vinegar, rice wine, or sherry, or red wine vinegar. And then you make this kind of what I call Italian chili crisp. And what it is just taking sliced garlic, extra virgin olive oil, some anchovies, red pepper flakes, and bringing that up to heat, like medium heat, until the oil becomes beautifully stained red, the garlic begins to crisp up, and the anchovies begin to melt away. And it becomes this super garlicky, savory sauce that I end up draping over the tomatoes. And then I just sprinkle with some basil, if you have, or whatever herb you'd like. But it's wonderful and something that you can do right then and there, and it comes together in minutes. But I think it also tastes very, very delicious if it does sit and you let that salt and that oil kind of sit with the tomatoes.
Oh, that sounds so good. I mean, honestly, like just those two things together, like a really beautiful grain salad and then like a juicy tomato salad with like chilies and garlic and anchovies like all over it. Like that's like, I mean, that could totally be my meal. I think people will probably expect a little bit more than that. They may not be as jaded as I am.
I think like when it comes to the cold dishes, room temp, I always think of something, two different type of salad-y items that have different textures. So the grain salad is going to give you kind of a briny, herby, the grains will have a nice chew to them and the tomatoes will be juicy. But then I also obviously want to take advantage of the grill.
Okay.
So in that sense, like I love eggplants. I find that on their own, they don't taste like much, but they will kind of pick up whatever you put on them. And so I kind of prefer the Japanese varieties. They kind of are almost snake-like rather than the Italian
like
varieties.
The really narrow ones, yeah.
Yeah, they cook up really, really quickly. I like leaving the skin on, and they almost, when cooked on the grill, they become almost custard-like, their flesh. It's so soft and yet meaty. And so what I do is I just slice them up in half, and I like to score the flesh, so whatever kind of rub or marinade I have can really get in there. And then I don't know about you, but I don't believe in salting my eggplants to remove the bitterness. The eggplants, to me, I feel like they've been bred out where there is no bitterness to them. But I do salt them just to kind of remove any excess water.
That's great.
Do you do that?
Like pre-cooking?
Mm-hmm. Pre-cooking.
Sometimes.
Sometimes.
I think with the Asian eggplants, like those little skinny ones, I usually don't. I just go and cook those. And actually, when you're saying on the grill, you mean just like take the thing. You're not even treating it or oiling or seasoning. You're just throwing it on the grill to cook it first, and then you slice it open and season it and marinate it.
I will slice them in a half lengthwise, score them, season them with a bit of salt. And I think there's two ways to go about it. I either will grill them until they're completely cooked through and then kind of dress them after they've been grilled while they're still hot. That could be with a dressing, or I will give them a kind of rub or marinade beforehand. Something that I feel like I tend to do with zucchinis and eggplants a lot is doing a kind of mixture of soy sauce, rice vinegar, and some kind of grated garlic, ginger. Sometimes I sneak in a little bit of chili or any kind of chili condiment I have. I just toss that in with a little bit of oil to ensure that it doesn't burn too much. And it's kind of a very simple glaze that I just kind of brush on the eggplants, not at the very beginning, but almost like 1/2 of the way it's cooked. That's so the soy doesn't burn. But you end up getting this really beautiful amber kind of glossy finish, and the eggplant becomes sticky and salty and vinegary. And so I love doing that with the eggplants or zucchinis, anything that's like a pretty kind of a vegetable that's quite watery. I feel like they can take a lot of flavor. So I like going for soy sauce and rice vinegar and chili and garlic. And then because the eggplants are so soft and custard-like, I try to add something that's crunchy. So I'll add like peanuts or cashews to top it off.
Oh, that sounds great. We're talking to Andy Baragani, author of The Cook You Want to Be, and we'll be back with him to take on some of your questions in a minute. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're here with Andy Baragani, author of The Cook You Want to Be, and we're talking about great things to make and eat in your backyard this summer. Let's get back to it with him. Okay, we also have a bunch of listeners who called in with questions. Let's take one of them right now. Let's go to Charlie.
Hi, my name's Charlie. I live in San Francisco, California. I just got a grill in my backyard. Yay. Excited to use it a lot this summer. But Andy, I was wondering what your favorite cuts of beef are for grilling and how you season those different cuts of beef. Thanks.
That's a great question. Thank you, Charlie. And thank you for representing the Bay Area. I was just in the Bay Area, my hometown. So when it comes to beef, I have to say I don't do kind of the low and slow. Not that I'm against it. I tend to go for steaks. I love strip steak and a ribeye. They have a lot of fat, intramuscular fat, and they're very forgiving. They could take high heat, so you'll get that wonderful burnished kind of crust on the outside and still get that nice pink center. With both those cuts, whether it's on the grill or on the stove in a cast iron, I season them ahead of time, so I really want that salt to get in there. And I just make sure that I pat it dry so I get rid of any kind of excess moisture on the surface so it does pick up a really nice crust.
When you say season ahead of time, I know they're like all these schools of thought, right? Only season right before you hit the heat, season it 2 days before, or season it at least 45 minutes before. I mean, people have like very different theories about when you should salt your meat. When you say season ahead of time, what do you mean?
So I'll say this. I know that when I am seasoning a protein, whether that is chicken or beef, I do like to salt it ahead of time and leave it in the fridge uncovered so it can kind of the exterior can kind of dry out. That allows for a better crust, a deeper, more golden crust, whether that's roast chicken or steak. But I don't necessarily am always I don't always have the time. And so I suggest just salting as soon as you can and for as long as you can, and no need to cover it. So with a cut of steak like this, I'm seasoning maybe a couple of hours beforehand, and it will still be very, very delicious, I promise. No need to stress about it.
Right on. You know, you're talking about a very classic, like, let's just really focus on the quality of the beef kind of preparation. It's just salt, beef, heat.
Yes.
But if you're thinking more about a more heavily seasoned treatment, you know, like, are you a fan of rubs? Are you a fan of marinades?
It depends on the cut, but I don't necessarily love marinades too much. I do tend to go for rubs. Let me take that back, because it's not so much I love rubs or don't like marinades. I like this kind of in between. I like paste. Okay. That's the thing. I really paste. Like thick paste. So I have one in my book that's like a shawarma spiced chicken, but it could also be done with lamb chops. And it's just a little tiny bit of yogurt, like a quarter cup, and turmeric, coriander, cumin, paprika, black pepper. And this is a yogurt marinade, I guess, but it is very thick and it's a small amount and just enough to kind of coat the meat. And it could be done on really any kind of meat that you'd like. But I also love, I have a marinade that's done with fresh chilies and lemongrass and garlic and ginger, and it's quite thick. And again, that's just enough to kind of coat the meat. And I love using that on ribeyes or short ribs. I should be doing it on some chicken thighs. I think that would be delicious.
Yeah, that sounds really good. I have to say, I love eating that way when other people are preparing it.
But you don't like doing it?
It's not even like I don't like to do it, but yeah, I think my instinct is maybe a little bit more like yours, since you first answered my question with like, oh, let's just salt it. Especially if you're thinking, hey, it's going to be part of a larger meal. And maybe it is that table that we've already imagined with those beautiful tomatoes, with that Italian garlicky anchovy chili oil on the tomatoes, and you have that like nice herby grain salad with bits of cheese in it. Like, oh, if, with that, like a very simple steak or a very simple grilled meat of any kind, chicken, pork chops, or whatever, I'm good with that. I don't need more layers of flavor in the meat itself, right? The meat is going to bring a lot of its own flavor to go with all those other flavors.
It can definitely get overwhelming. And actually, you brought up a good point. I find that if you're not too experienced working a grill, whether it's vegetables or protein, I think just simple salt and pepper and oil and grilling it and then kind of treating it afterwards with a sauce is really, really nice. You know, a lot of recipes will suggest putting this like very intense rub on the meat, but then I find that the spices, more often than not, they tend to kind of burn and toast too far. Yeah. And so I don't love doing kind of a coarsely crushed spiced rub, because I just find that the spices become way too bitter. But I think just doing a simple salt, oil, and then coming up with a sauce, a cold sauce, a kind of a variation on a salsa verde or a creamy dish or something hot and tangy to drizzle over. The meat will still be warm and you could drizzle that over and it will kind of soak it up. So if you're too nervous on coming up with the right rub or paste, you can always just do a simple preparation of salt and oil and then just sauce it up afterwards.
Yeah, I love that. Anyway, let's go to another call. Actually, let's stay on the grill. Let's go to Andrea and Diana.
Great.
Hey, Splendid Table. This is Diana.
And Andrea.
Our friend Caro's birthday falls on the 4th, and every year we do a barbecue. This year we wanted to try something different.
Something that isn't burgers or hot dogs on the grill.
Do you have any great ideas for fish on the grill, maybe?
Oh,
Andy, I think, I don't mean to typecast you. I think the first time we had you on the show, we were talking about grilling whole fish.
Yes.
It was a couple years ago, but I think that was true.
Well, I will say that my philosophy and approach has still stayed the same, but I will tweak it for Andrea and Diana. I think, go with the whole fish. I think it's something that Francis is like, what are you saying? It's too bold. But I do believe it, because I think a whole fish, as long as it's on the smaller size, I'm talking about 1 to 2 pounds, keeping the preparation super simple, just kind of salt and oil and rubbing it all over with oil and the grates and just throwing it on the grill. And I promise, like, once the skin gets crisp, just turn it over away from you. I like using a large spatula for that, but again, just keep the fish a moderate size, 1 to 2 pounds. And then I think what's really delicious with fish is I tend to throw a bunch of scallions on the grill and maybe some green chilies, jalapenos or serranos, get them nice and charred. And then I chop everything up, a squeeze of lime, some cilantro, a little bit of extra virgin olive oil, and you have this kind of spicy scallion-y sauce, and I just spoon it over the fish. I think Francis thinks like this is too intimidating, but I want to normalize whole fish cooking.
Okay. Is it 1 to 2 pounds on the fish? What kind of fish? Do you have a preference? Or
I like black bass. I think black bass is a great, easy, small fish to use.
And one thing you noted that I do think is important is making sure you have oil all over the fish, but you're also oiling the grates of the grill. And I think people sometimes forget that that is a thing you can do. And I don't think it really matters what oil is. Do you, Andy? Like, could be olive oil, could be canola oil.
It could be any kind of oil, really. You're just creating a non-stick surface.
Yeah. So like oil that up nicely and then rub it all over the grates. Not like dripping oil so it doesn't like flare up, but like just enough where you see the grates nice and shiny after you've done it. And that is actually creating a slight non-stick barrier for you. So that also helps. And then you just lay the fish on, right? You just kind of lay it on and let it cook. Kind of don't mess with it for a while.
Just lay the fish on. I think why I like doing small whole fish is because when you're using fillets, like skin-on fillets, the skin, you want it to kind of get crisp and puff up, and it actually acts as a kind of indicator on when to turn. But if you're flipping a skin-on fillet on the other side where it doesn't have the skin, I just find that more often than not, it always sticks. And so I like to do kind of, I prefer small whole fish versus fillets on the grill.
Yeah, the skin is really key here. And I think the key also is like, don't mess with it. Just let it cook.
No, just let it cook.
Because that skin, it will stick at first, right? It will, like all proteins basically want to stick the first time it hits the heat. But if you let it cook, then the skin kind of crisps up and loses its moisture. It kind of releases itself.
The skin, the fish will whisper to you and say, I'm ready to let go. And then you could flip it.
Yeah, then you just pry. You don't have to pick it up to flip it. I think Andy taught me this technique years ago. Like, you get that spatula underneath it when it releases and just kind of roll it away
from you. Yes.
Yeah. Great. Cool. Let's go to another caller. And let's go to Joshua.
Hello, Splendid. So my family always gets together for the 4th and we make a big meal for around 20 people. We typically make a large salad with a balsamic vinaigrette, but I'd like to make another salad dressing this year. And I wanted to see if you have any recommendations on a simple dressing that we can use for multiple meals. Thanks.
Right on. Andy, I have to tell you this. I'm not good at making salad dressing.
What?
Oh. Like, I know it's the simplest thing in the world. I know it's like, 3-to-1 vinegar to oil or oil to vinegar. And you can add I know the whole thing. And every time I make it, I'm like, it's fine. I don't know what it is with me and vinaigrettes. I know how to make them. And for some reason, they just never taste great. It's always like, that's fine.
Oh, you're talking to someone who feels like very, very comfortable. I think the salad chapter is the second biggest chapter in my book. I love salads and I grew up having salad every single day. My dad still always has to have salad with every meal. I love this question because we're all looking for a kind of all-purpose sauce that we can use throughout the week and hopefully throughout this meal for July 4th. I will say that I tend to be drawn to a kind of a herby vinaigrette because there's the salsa verdes, which can be a little bit thicker. There's the vinaigrettes, which can be super acidic, and it's tricky for them to be all-purpose. And then there's the other category that I do love, which are the kind of creamy, rich sauces. So I try to do something that's a little bit in between. And what I like to do is take some kind of oniony item. I think this works with shallots or scallions or just a clove of garlic. Either finely chop that, or if it's garlic, just grate it. And we're just talking about one small shallot, maybe two scallions, or one small garlic clove. And then what makes this so great is two different acids, a splash of vinegar. This works with red wine vinegar, white wine vinegar, or rice vinegar. And then I add another acid in the form of citrus. So I like using lemon juice or grapefruit juice. And that kind of gives like another layer, a different kind of note. The vinegar will add this kind of sharpness, this acidity that's hits you at the forefront. But citrus it'll soften everything, and especially when you use the zest of a lemon or a grapefruit, it will add almost a floral note. And then I like adding a tender herb, either like a tablespoon or two of chopped parsley or cilantro or mint. Any of these kind of work. You just want some kind of green item in there. And then I add some kind of fat in the form of yogurt. Greek yogurt is fine, or plain yogurt. You're just looking for some kind of dairy fat. I've even used sour cream sometimes, but really this isn't necessarily a heavy yogurty sauce. This is just like a tablespoon or two to add richness, and it will kind of cling on to anything it touches. And then it'll still be quite loose from the vinegar and the citrus juice. And then I stream some oil in, some salt and pepper, and you end up having this kind of herby, citrusy, creamy sauce, and it touches on multiple notes. It's not so loose as a vinaigrette. It's not so thick as like a ranch. It does a lot of different things. And I think it's such a easy base because you could make it spicy if you want and add more pepper or a fancy kind of chili flake to it or not. You could smash up an anchovy or two or not. But I think this is a kind of a base recipe where it's just the kind of some kind of allium, the two acids, dairy, and olive oil, and an herb, and it really works for just anything. I would use this for the grain salad. I would pour this over the tomato salad. I could even eat this with a lot of different proteins. It touches on so many different notes.
Yeah, I love that. It's funny you say this because I am not great at making vinaigrettes, but I do make like a buttermilk herb dressing that I'll just keep in my fridge. And it's very similar to what you described. I'll depending on what I have, maybe it's garlic or shallot, chop it up. And I always like to get whatever that is, the oniony, garlicky thing, hanging out with an acidic thing for a while before I do anything else. I feel like that acid kind of mellows the sharpness, mellows the bite of like raw garlic.
Yes, it macerates and softens its bite for sure. It's it kind of tames its onioniness.
Yeah, so I love doing that as a first step. I just do it with like a lot of buttermilk, and maybe I'll thicken that even a little bit more with sour cream or yogurt.
I love the buttermilk,
but it has a little bit of that acidic flavor from the acid, and buttermilk is actually naturally acidic a little bit. And I'll just stream a little olive oil just for richness, and then just like a fistful of chopped herbs, and I just let it hang out. Like I'll use it right away, or like I'll just put it in a jar and keep it in my fridge. Honestly, like
it's very forgiving. I find that any kind of like a dairy based herby dressing like this, it's very forgiving. You could make it the day before, and it always tastes so good, and it works on everything somehow.
Yeah, literally, like I'll dress a salad with it, or I'll just like bake a piece of fish, and then like that goes on the bottom of the plate with the fish and some boiled or roasted potatoes and some vegetables. Like you use it on top of things, in things, over things. Like it's just always good.
See, I don't believe you anymore, Francis. You know how to make dressing. You know how to make you can make sauces. You can,
it's like
know,
the one I'm, move. That's like
I'm
my
waiting
one move.
For the book on condiments from you.
All right, let's do another call. And since we're talking about dressings, let's go to Jen.
Hey, Francis, it's Jen from Minnesota. I'm looking for ideas for a barbecue I've got coming up. I'm making hamburgers, hot dogs, things like that, veggie burgers. Mm-hmm. And I'd love a salad complement that works for both adults and elementary school kids. Something that is healthy and delicious, if possible, would be amazing. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Jen.
Thank you, Jen, for that question. Francis, do you know where my mind went as soon as I heard a salad for both adults and kids?
No.
Potato salad. I think you could do so many things with it. I prefer a potato salad to be a little bit more on the kind of vinegary, mustardy rather than the kind of mayonnaise and dairy heavy side. I think one thing people should know that's very important is that if you're going for kind of mustardy, vinegary potatoes, you want to dress your potatoes while they're still warm after they've been boiled. So that's how they can soak up that dressing. But if you're doing a kind of mayonnaise-y or you're doing something with yogurt or sour cream, that should be dressed when the potatoes are at room temp or cold. Otherwise, I find that the fat kind of separates and it doesn't look great.
Oh, that's so interesting. Okay, right on.
But I love just boiled in potatoes until they're soft, kind of almost like golf ball size, really, really creamy. And then while it's still warm, but you're able to handle them with your hands, I just give them a little bit of a slight smush. And then I make a dressing with chopped up. I like using preserved lemon. I promise you the kids will not know this. It's just going to taste like something bright and acidic. And a lot of olive oil and salt and pepper. And you could throw in some shaved Parmesan in there and then toss in your potatoes. And it becomes this like lemony Parmesan, olive oily dressing. I have been known to swap out the olive oil for butter, which just takes it to a very, very, very special place. And tons of black pepper. If you think the kids...
They're just melted butter.
Oh, yeah. It's just like the butter and the preserved lemon and the Parmesan. It really works.
Oh, God, that sounds good.
Oh, well. And plenty of pepper. I like adding a lot of dill to this, but I know that we are working with elementary school kids. But a little bit. Maybe if you chop it really, really finely, they won't be able to see it. But that's how I do my potato salad that I love.
That sounds super good. All right, Andy. Well, I know that you started by saying, oh, do you want to know what I'm making for 4th of July? So I expect the invitation.
I promise I will get you over, but I'm going to make you in charge of all the sauces.
Deal. All right, Andy, it's been a blast. Thank you so much and have a great 4th.
Thank you, Francis. You too. Have a lovely 4th of July.
Andy Barragani is the author of The Cook You Want to Be. He left us with some recipes. Find that juicy tomato with Italian chili crisp. God, that sounds good. And glossy barbecued eggplant with peanut salad at splendidtable.org. And hey, it is always so fun to talk to you, too. If you got questions for us, record them as voice memos on your phone and email them to contact@splendidtable.org. Coming up, summer baking and non-baking with Sam Senavaratna, author of The Joys of Baking. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and you're listening to the show for curious cooks and eaters. So surely, truly, no picnic, cookout, or barbecue is complete without dessert. But do you want to be baking in 95 degrees? I mean, some people do, and those people are the angels among us. Samantha Senavaratna is one of those people. She's the author of The Joys of Baking. She's a food stylist and recipe developer for many publications and clients. She joins us now. Hey, Sam.
Hi, Francis.
Oh, it's great to talk with you. I have a question for you.
Tell me.
Are you a summer person?
I am.
Because you're such a baker. And there are some bakers who are like, I want to be in an oven, so no, I'm definitely not a summer person.
I am a summer person. I am. My family is from Sri Lanka, so I always say that I'm of tropical blood. Yeah. So I am made for heat. I love to literally bake and bake in the oven.
Just the more heat, the better, no matter where it comes from.
Yes.
That's awesome. So what are you looking forward to this summer? Where are you going to get hot and sweaty?
We're going to do some traveling. I'm pretty excited. I'm taking my son, Arthur, who will be turning 5 at the end of the month, on his first international adventure. We're going to Costa Rica for a week, and then we're going to France for a little bit in August. So we'll see how that goes. But I'm pretty excited. I think he's going to love it. I love to travel, so I'm hoping to infect him with the travel bug as early as possible.
Oh, that's very nice. That's very nice. I used to love to, like, really travel, like go and run around and, you know, see the sights and meet the people and eat the food. And now your child is you know, a similar age to my own. Like, all I want to do is go and, like, sit down somewhere. It could be in the backyard.
Sit around.
Or it could be in some wonderful locale. But either way, I'm like, oh, hey, we're here. Let's just sit.
Let's stop moving. Yeah, exactly. That's pretty much our plan. It's sweet. We planned this trip to Costa Rica, and it had a lot of adventure, you know, zip lining and rafting and all this stuff. And I said, you know what? I think that's too much movement for us. We just want to sit some. Can we just fly somewhere and then sit somewhere and eat something good? That's my whole plan.
Perfect. That sounds great. So actually that brings us to our conversation today, because we are going to pretend that we are going to go sit somewhere and eat something good. Maybe it's in a backyard for, you know, a nice cookout, or maybe it's a picnic in the park. But I really wanted to talk with you, like I said, because you are such a great baker, about summer dessert ideas.
Summer is, I mean, it's the best time for baking because you have all the fruits at your disposal. I mean, I live on the East Coast, so summertime is really when the fruit happens, right? We don't get it in other times of the year. So that's when I like to go and really, really experiment and, you know, just use what is exactly in season right then, right there.
Okay. So what you got?
Well, so I know that summertime is a big fruit pie season, but to me, I think that the ratio of crust to fruit in a standard fruit pie, blueberry pie or something like that, is not, I don't like that ratio. It's too much soup. It's too much fruit soup. So to me, the perfect thing to do in the summer is to make fruit galettes. So I basically use the same standard butter pastry that I would normally, but instead of using, you know, 5 cups of fruit, I take it down to maybe 2 or 3 and then just fold it into a pastry shell and bake it flat so that it sort of, it gets, the fruit intensifies more, there's less liquid, and I think the ratio of crust to fruit is better. So that, fruit galettes are pretty much my go-to. And at this point, you know, if you have a butter pastry recipe that you use and that you love, that's the only recipe that you need. You can kind of just wing it with the filling and just use whatever you find.
Okay, so it's basically a pie, because you're saying you're literally using the same pie crust, pie dough recipe that you really like. And it's just a different shape and a different ratio.
Different thickness.
Okay.
It's the thickness. Because also I find even my fruit galettes leak sometimes. You know, if I'm making a blueberry galette or something, they're so juicy, right? So sometimes it leaks, a little bit of the juice leaks out. But I kind of think that's a good thing because then extra moisture leaks out, the fruit sort of concentrates more, and then you have something that you can sort of slice and pick up and eat moving around if you want to. And the fruit flavor is just so much more concentrated. You also don't have to wait. The thing about making a fruit pie that drives me crazy is that you have to wait for like, I don't know, 3 hours, like hours or something like that for it to set up so that you can actually slice it. Yeah. Oh my gosh, it drives me crazy. So, but with a galette, you need not wait. And so that's my favorite thing.
Okay, so the beauty of the fruit galette is it's basically like, forgive me for saying this, this is such a dumb thing to say, I'm going to say it anyway. It's like a fruit pizza, right? You're taking the pie dough.
Yeah.
You're basically rolling out into a circle.
Yeah.
You're filling
it's
the
fruit pizza.
You're putting it sounds a lot less cool when you call it a fruit pizza, but that's how I think of it. You're putting the fruit filling on top, and then you're just kind of like folding the edge over a little bit. You're not uncovering the whole thing, right? In covering.
Right,
that's not a word.
Exactly.
You're not encasing the whole thing.
Encasing it. But you pulled it up at least a couple inches, you know, so that you have a nice border. But I find that because the top is exposed too, you get a lot more more of the liquid sort of cooks off, and so you get a better fruit flavor in the end.
Beautiful.
Okay, I'm
better
team
fruit
galette
pizza.
All the way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fruit pizza. Fruit pizza. That's it. My next book.
And when you're making your wonderful refined fruit pizza, so we're using the same pie dough recipe. Would you change? Like, can you just take any old fruit pie recipe and just bake it in that form? Obviously, you're saying you use less fruit because you're not going to. It's not deep. It's not. You're not trying to like pile the fruit on. But would you just use the same filling flavor and the same filling and just you'll have some left over?
Yes, you absolutely can. I would probably just, because in the summer the fruit is so special, I would probably just keep it as simple as possible and do a little bit of sugar, a little bit of cornstarch, and then a little bit of extra butter and call it a day. That's pretty much all I would put in my fruit mixture. But you certainly could jazz it up if you wanted to. Vanilla beans or, you know, what else could you put? Other spices if you wanted to. So yeah, sure. Trust your favorite pie recipe and then just scale it down a little bit.
Yeah, or just like, oh, you have some fruit filling left over and...
Yeah.
And then fine, you cook it on the stovetop or something. It's a little fruit mixture.
A little fruit compote for ice cream or something like that. Yeah,
fruit compote is a nicer word than fruit mixture, but you're talking to the guy that just invented fruit pizza. Actually, while we're talking about this subject, I know we just shaded pie a little bit, but... You have this great recipe for strawberry pie where you have strawberry in like lots of different forms. Can you just talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Well, this is not a concept that I invented. It's a fresh strawberry pie. So what I do is take, I think it's about 8 cups of fresh strawberries when they're perfectly in season. And then you cook down about 2 cups of it, so you have sort of a quick jam. I fold in a little bit of strawberry preserves just to sort of up the strawberry flavor. And then that becomes the binder. So that you sort of fold in with the rest of your fresh fruit, put that into your pie crust, and then chill it. And then it sort of firms up, and you get just this beautiful pie that is just bursting with fresh strawberry flavor. I don't know about you, but I don't love the flavor of cooked strawberries so much. I think strawberries are really at their best when they're fresh. So this pie sort of blends the best of both worlds because you get to eat a pie, but you don't have any, you know, that like runny, mushy fruit soup that comes in pie sometimes.
Yeah, no, I like a cooked strawberry just fine, but I totally hear you. The absolute best strawberry is the one that's, holy cow, it's so juicy and clear. And, you know, strawberries are never like, or very rarely are they like super sugar sweet, but they're just
right
when they just feel like the, someone once described, a really nice strawberry to me once is, it's like the best glass of water you've ever had, which sounds crazy, except that like, oh, it's like that clear, refreshing, like when you're really thirsty and you have a glass of ice water, you're just like, like that's you're what so a really right. great strawberry does. It makes you go,
A perfect strawberry is totally refreshing. There are some fruits that aren't that way, but a perfect strawberry is refreshing.
Yeah.
That's right. That's
super good. So I love that idea. So you cook about a quarter of your strawberries, amp it up with some strawberry jam, and then the rest is just the fresh, maybe
just the
like
fresh.
Sliced or quartered strawberries.
If they're really big, you could quarter them or halve them or something like that. It looks pretty too. You know, it has that like really bountiful, summery look to it. And you can top it with whipped cream or ice cream or nothing. I mean, really. My friend was just telling me she makes it every... in the summer, she makes it all the time, and her daughter likes to eat it for breakfast just as is. So that is the best compliment I could ever receive.
I love it. And then you just tuck that into a pre-baked
You can shell. Use a pre-break. You can use a graham cracker crust or something like that. I like shortbread cookies, so I just make a quick crust with ground-up shortbread cookies and a little bit of sugar. That's the only baking that needs to happen. So you bake that for, what, eight, 10 minutes at 350 until that's solid. And then that your baking is done. So that's also good in the summer because then you don't have to heat up your kitchen.
I love it. Okay, so say we're the kind of people not like you. And like you said, we're very averse to heating up our kitchen. You really don't want to bake. What do you say for us? What should we have for dessert for our beautiful little cookout?
The good news is... ice cream is a huge crowd pleaser, right? And you can buy really good ice cream. You need, you know, you don't need to make your own ice cream or anything like that. So I like, there is, I don't know if I can mention a brand, but there is a frozen pound cake. Really? Okay. So Sara Lee frozen pound cake.
Oh my God. I grew up with that stuff and I absolutely adore it. And
I love it too. Yeah. Oh, I'm so glad to hear it because I feel like it, you know, not everybody's going to love it. But also the good thing about the Sara Lee pound cake is that it tastes good frozen as opposed to other things that you might, you know, other cake that you might make from scratch that isn't so nice frozen. But Sara Lee pound cakes are really, really good frozen. So a really easy, fun dessert is you can take one of those pound cakes, slice it, and layer it in the loaf pan with whatever your favorite ice cream is, store-bought ice cream. And you could also layer it with a little bit of store-bought hot fudge or caramel sauce or, you know, leftover fruit compote from your pie or whatever you find that you like. And you can make a beautiful layered dessert out of all pretty much store-bought things. Throw that in your freezer, forget about it. And then when you're ready to serve it, pop it out. And you can either just serve it as is or you could top it with, you know, you could cover it with a whipped cream or meringue would even be nice if you wanted to. That's taking it another step. But, you know, you could even just serve it as is with a little whipped cream on the side. And it looks pretty and it's very easy.
I love that. So you're basically like making a fruit lasagna, an ice cream lasagna. Can I take this even further?
Yes. It's an ice cream lasagna in a loaf pan. The only thing is you have to make sure you have to line that loaf pan really well with plastic wrap, a couple layers of plastic or wax paper or something like that so that you can get it out of the
You can just lift it out
of the dish. But then you have no work and your kitchen stays nice and cool.
That's beautiful. Or a frozen trifle. We can call a frozen...
Oh, yeah. That's a nicer way to put it.
An ice cream terrine.
A terrine.
That sounds classier than an ice cream lasagna. Yeah. Okay, question about this. I am a little bit maniacal about ice cream texture. I absolutely drives me crazy when ice cream is hard and icy, when it's crystallized.
So like if it melts and refreezes?
Yeah. Like I find it inedible after that. My wife was like, it's still ice cream. What's wrong with you? I'm like, I just can't do it. But there is a texture, like the texture changes if it melts and refreezes, because how you make ice cream is you have to like churn it while you're freezing it, so the ice crystals never really form. That's why it's all smooth and silky and luscious. So anyway, when you're talking about scooping the ice cream out and like, you know, and you know, layering it into the pan and smoothing it out, it is gonna melt, right? So how do you keep it smooth and luscious? Do you have any tips for that?
Okay, I have to say I'm not as fanatical as you, so I will eat ice cream in any form, so you're melted,
Francis, this is your problem.
Refrozen. Whatever, but we can solve this problem. So I think what you would want to do then is basically buy, if you buy not the little pints of ice cream, but the bigger quarts of ice cream, then you could use a serrated knife to basically slice planks of ice cream.
Oh,
so that
wow.
then basically it never, I mean, you have to work fast. You're going to probably make a mess. But I think, or even if you buy the little pints, if you slice planks while it's still cold, then you can sort of layer the planks in your loaf pan and call it a day. I think that would work just fine. But you have to work fast. And it probably, you know, because home refrigerators are not, you know, they sort of cool down and warm up and cool down and warm up. So you might have a little bit of melting and refreezing, but hopefully that would minimize it.
Yeah.
But you know what else you could do? My friend Allie Slagle makes this awesome ice cream cake where she takes ice cream sandwiches and she layers them with ice cream in a baking dish. And you could do that with the pound cake. You could just use like store-bought ice cream sandwiches or other ice cream bars that you find and layer those so that you don't even have to let them melt at all. Would that work?
Literally unwrapping ice cream sandwiches and then putting them into a pan.
I mean,
and then putting more ice cream on top, like different ice cream on top. Now this is an ice cream sandwich lasagna.
That's an ice cream sandwich lasagna, but it's so good. And everybody loves ice cream sandwiches, right? So with so little work, you have all these beautiful layers of delicious things. And that would solve your melting problem, right?
Well, it's a little Frankenstein-y, but okay.
Okay,
you know, actually my next question for you was, and what should those of us do who are really lazy? But I think we just covered that.
That's the laziest.
Unwrap some ice cream sandwiches.
Layer,
oh,
yeah.
Oh, what? I put them in a pan laziest. For you.
Yeah. You did the work of unwrapping. That's a gift to your guests.
Great. Okay, one more question. Because we touched on strawberries, which I do adore. And they do, depending on where you are in the country, they tend to be more like an early summer. And then maybe if you have two seasons, they come back around late summer or maybe in the fall. In the height of summer, what are your favorite fruits to play with?
Oh, I mean, peaches. Peaches are my absolute favorite because...
Oh, yeah, me too.
When you get one that is perfect, when you get a batch that is perfect, it's like nothing else, you know? And they only come around for such a short amount of time. And I know it is a little bit criminal to cook with them because they're so special just to eat, you know, and make a mess standing up over the sink.
Yeah, when they're super juicy. And yeah, that's the absolute best.
Yeah. But, I mean, a peach pie, you know, a peach raspberry galette, that is a special, special summer thing. Peaches, by far. They're my favorite.
Right on. Well, thank you so much, Sam. This has been a real blast.
Thank you, Francis. Thank you for having me.
Have a great summer and have a great 4th of July.
Thank you. You too. Eat lots of peaches.
I will. Oh, man. Absolutely. Samantha Senavaratna is the author of The Joys of Baking. You can find her recipe for nectarine galette with sour jam on our website, splendidtable.org. And if you want to check out her fresh strawberry pie, it's so good. You can find that recipe at New York Times Cooking. Well, that's our show for the week. Hope you have a very delicious midsummer. And hey, again, if you have cooking questions for us, email them to us. Record a voice memo on your phone and send them to contact@splendidtable.org. We'll talk to you next week. APM Studios are run by Chandra Kavati, Alex Schaffert, and Joanne Griffith. Beth Perlman's our executive producer. Splendid Table was created by Sally Swift and Lynn Rosetta Casper, and it's made every week by technical producer Jenny Lukey, producer Erica Romero, digital producer James Napoli, and managing producer Sally Swift. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM Studios.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.